Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Arizona Senator Jeff Flake was one of the plainest speaking Republican opponents of Donald Trump's presidential campaign. He openly criticized Trump and said he couldn't vote for him. That ultimately drew the wrath of Trump, who called Flake, quote, weak and ineffective. Now that Trump is president-elect, we're checking back in with Senator Flake to get his reaction. Senator, you've joked about eating crow because of the Trump victory. How shocked, how surprised are you that Donald Trump actually won on Tuesday?
I was floored, I have to say. I didn't predict this, and if any of your listeners are thinking that I can predict the future, I think they know better by now. My only consolation is that I wasn't alone.
You know, there are a lot of people, some individuals, some Republicans, and many Democrats, and many people of certain ethnic groups who are concerned. They're even scared at this point. Do they have reason to be?
You know, I was very heartened by the speech that Donald Trump gave just after he won. Where he promised to reach out to those who disagreed with him. I think at this point, it's up to us. I was advocating the same thing when I thought it would go the other way, when people were talking about on the Republican side not accepting the election result. I think we ought to assume the best and look for the good and move ahead.
Should there be more concern about some people feeling empowered because they may construe or misconstrue why he got elected?
No, I don't know. I think we have to take with a grain of salt a lot of what is said during it. Election campaign. Obviously, some of the things that positions he took, people like me will push back on. There's a lot we'll agree on as well. But I think you have to recognize this was a campaign, and both sides said things they probably want to take back.
Well, the pushback is a good segue for us, because there will be Republicans in control of the Senate and the House, and now the White House as well. How much do you think there will be a pushback on certain issues? Are there any that come to mind for you right away?
Well, trade. Donald Trump has talked about renegotiating NAFTA. We're not entering into free trade agreements. So I think it's extremely important that we continue to enter into multilateral free trade agreements. If we don't, the rest of the world will, and we'll be the poorer for it. In my view, globalization has happened. It's accelerating, and the way for us to catch up is to enter into free trade agreements. Because, like I said, countries have choices, and they'll move ahead without us. So that's an area that we'll certainly push back on.
And you have a lot of connections across the world, and we've heard the Russian reaction. We've heard from China. We've heard from Mexico. What are you hearing in general from folks in other countries? Are they, whenever there's a change in power, people are nervous to some extent one way or the other, but are people enthusiastic? Are they especially nervous about this particular man in the White House?
Well, there's a lot of interest. I was in Europe a couple of weeks ago, in Southern Africa months ago. There's nothing that people want to talk about as much as the U.S. presidential campaign. And some people are concerned, but a lot of it is believing too much of what is said during an election campaign. Or taking it to the extreme, not realizing that when a president gets in office, he obviously has the Congress to work with, has the courts to also set guardrails around what a president does. And so I think, and then you know, as soon as the campaign is over, you'll have Donald Trump, or it would have been Hillary Clinton if she had been elected, kind of downplay some expectations about, extreme measures that might be taken. I mean, campaigns really polarize, and gratefully, we've had a tradition in this country, and we certainly have seen it in the last 2 days where we come together.
So since you're a Republican, I presume you're looking forward to the GOP controlling the White House, Senate, and the House, but in what ways is that actually good for the country? Some people think divided government actually works. Other people say, well, that leads us to gridlock.
Having control of both chambers in the White House, I think, will be very, very beneficial in one respect, and right away. One, to deal with Obamacare, particularly in Arizona, is not working, is not sustainable. When you're seeing the increases, I'm at the gym almost every morning, and I sit on my stationary bike, and there's a kind of a walkway that goes right in front of it. And sometimes there's a lineup of people who want to tell me their Obamacare horror stories. So that's one area that benefits from having control of both chambers and the White House to move expeditiously. One part that I think will suffer, unfortunately, is we need the big deal, the grand bargain on entitlement reform and revenue moving ahead to deal with our massive debt and persistent deficit. That really only happens when you have divided government, because both parties really need to buy in and hold hands and jump together, frankly. There was very little talk at all in the campaign from either campaign about debt and deficit and how to deal with it. And I can tell you, having been already in a position years ago where Republicans were in control of both chambers in the White House, you don't dare move ahead on big ticket things like that, because you bear all the blame in midterm elections just around the corner, and you just won't assume that that kind of liability. So that will suffer.
Let's come back briefly to the Affordable Care Act, to Obamacare, and obviously Donald Trump wants to overturn it. Many Republicans in the House have tried that during the Obama presidency. There are people who like certain aspects of it, though. Do you have confidence that if people decide to get rid of Obamacare, if folks in the House and Senate do that, that it can be replaced with something that Americans can embrace that will work better? Because a lot of people don't have confidence in that.
Yes. I mean, it's hard to think that it can be worse than it is right now. It's just not affordable for the majority of those who have to rely on it. Obviously, there's concern about dealing with uninsurables, people who simply have pre-existing conditions that can't get coverage. We have to deal with that. It used to be done with state-based risk pools. Some worked well, some really didn't. You know, how do we do that going forward? That's something we have to figure out. But in terms of making healthcare affordable to others, we've got to change it. It's not working, and Arizonans will tell you that.
U.S. Senator from Arizona, Jeff Flake. Senator, thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody, along with Phil Latzman.
And Mark, on the day that we praise the valor of our veterans, we continue to lose many in the so-called greatest generation, those who fought in World War II.
And that includes the many Native Americans who served, including the Navajo Code Talkers.
They were the bilingual branch of the U.S. Marines, recruited specifically to use their native Diné tongue to develop a code to baffle and outsmart the Japanese in the South Pacific. And it worked so well, many believe it may have been the key to an American victory.
The Navajo Nation reported this week that another Navajo code talker has died. George Paul James passed away in New Mexico yesterday. Tribal officials say James died at an Albuquerque hospital at the age of 92.
And of the hundreds of original code talkers, there are now just a handful left. Back in 2014, we lost Samuel Jesse Smith, a code talker from Window Rock. Before his death, he returned to the South Pacific to discuss his heroic role in the war in a documentary heard on the Public Radio Exchange.
I'm glad I've been there. I'm glad to have done what I did. At the beginning, I wanted to be a pilot, but then this one turned out all right. Us code talkers were there. And that's how the war was won, period.
And joining us now is Samuel Jesse Smith's son, Michael, himself a U.S. Marine veteran who now serves as a clerk for the Navajo Supreme Court. Michael, thanks for your service and for joining us. So first of all, tell us a little bit about how the Code Talkers worked this magic.
The code was developed by the Navajo Code Talkers orally. Because Navajo at the time was not a written language. So what they basically had to do is create characters in the language that wasn't written. They had to learn how to write. First they had to learn how to write the language. But they created a code within the language. So no Navajo that was on the radio that heard them speaking could understand what they were saying, even though they knew the language. So it was a code within the language.
There were over 400 Navajo code talkers that served in the Marines during World War II. There are only 14 left. We just lost another one this week. When you see a report of another death, how does that resound on the Navajo Nation and among veterans on this Veterans Day?
It really hits. it really hits close to heart, because they know all of these men, and on the Navajo Nation, they are all revered as heroes, Navajo Nation heroes, national heroes. And when a co-talker passes on, it's like the realization of the closing of an era, and it's pretty sad. But for me, what I like to do is I like to celebrate their life, celebrate their history, celebrate their families, and encourage families to record or to compilate the memories that they have of their Navajo co-talker, and preserve their legacy for generations, for their family, and for the Navajo Nation.
How do you observe Veterans Day on the Navajo Nation?
Per capita, Native Americans have a large veteran base. We are one of the largest ethnic groups that volunteer for services within the armed forces. And for that, the Navajo Nation is really proud. And the Navajo Nation continues to take extra steps to celebrate their veterans. And each of the chapters will proudly display their veterans in their chapter houses. And today, or yesterday, there was a veterans parade. And so there's different activities that are going on throughout the Navajo Nation. And I just want to thank all the veterans on the Navajo Nation for their service, as well as in Arizona and the United States.
And Michael, it just occurred to me that when your dad and the other 400 Navajo co-talkers were helping the United States win World War II, they weren't even able to vote until 1948.
That's correct.
I mean, that's amazing,
Absolutely,
isn't it?
Correct. It is totally amazing. And the respect that Native Americans had at the time, too, it was a hard sell to think that Native Americans had this ability to create a code and to this date have the only code, the only military code that has never been broken. And that is just amazing that legacy still stands today.
Michael Smith is a Marine veteran. His dad, Samuel Jesse Smith, was a Navajo co-talker during World War II. Happy Veterans Day to you, Mr. Smith. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much for giving me a call and for this interview. And I just like to say Happy Veterans Day to all of our veterans in the area and in Arizona, on the Navajo Nation, all the Indian nations in Arizona, and throughout the United States. I really appreciate it.
It's a growing trend in more and more cities across Arizona. Veterans courts are working to solve the issue of veteran incarceration by offering alternatives to jail time. KJZZ's Olivia Richard reports.
But people get through and it's good enough.
For most people, the last place you'd want to end up is standing in a courtroom in front of a judge. But one unconventional Maricopa County court is offering veterans like former Airman Brian Henschel a second chance.
There's a lot of people here that really want to help you, and they take a different approach at they're looking to fix the person and help you take care of yourself, leave in a better position than you came in.
After completing a tour in South Korea as a navigation specialist, returning home was a struggle.
I was basically ran out of options. I was out on the street and scraping together, change or whatever, anything I could to, get fed. But my housing situation was pretty bleak. I got in a little bit of trouble, and I ended up coming to intake court here, and then they shipped me upstairs to Veterans Court.
That's when he met Navy veteran Raqib Abdullah.
I'm a graduate of this court. I came through this court, and I was charged with assault. It was through this court that I was able to pay it forward.
After graduating from the program, Abdullah decided.
And what I do is I volunteer my time. because I care about what it is I'm doing, because I know what the trials and tribulations they're going through to be the type of people they need to be in order for them to move forward in their life.
County Prosecutor Patricia George, who launched the Phoenix branch of the program in 2012, says it's a joint effort.
So Vets Court really takes every possible player that's willing to come to the table into one spot to work with our veterans, so that whoever comes through our door doesn't come back again.
And that's a role Abdullah takes very seriously.
The whole idea of mentoring is to be a battle buddy to the person who is coming in and out of court. And sometimes just being a person that they can talk to when they're going through some life changes.
George says mentors like Abdullah have helped make the program successful.
If they go to the appropriate programs, we're finding those recidivism rates are really low. We're right at about the 4% for them coming back into our court, which is phenomenal.
According to a national justice study, more than two-thirds of all prisoners are rearrested within 3 years of release. Henshaw says the program has changed his life.
To explain, you know, it's 20 years, you gotta serve 20 years to, you know, retire and get benefits. So just serving 4 years wasn't quite enough. I qualified for medical benefits that I didn't realize that I had.
Since being in veterans court, he's found housing, gained access to VA medical benefits, and he's on track to graduate the program.
Still looking for work, so if I find a job, I think they're going to probably have me on a graduation path. I used to work avionics, and I got a degree in electronics, so I'm looking for something, maybe avionics, tech position. That's what I'm trying to right now. If I can find something full-time, I'm willing to clean offices.
When an individual graduates the court, George says they receive two very important things.
So they get a certificate that indicates that they have successfully completed Veterans Court. They also get a challenge coin, which is part of the military culture. That coin is not just a recognition of their service. It's a reminder of where you were and where you are, and to keep looking forward and succeed in whatever you're doing.
Abdullah says he doesn't need a coin to remind him of what he's overcome.
I'm happy. That's how it's changed. I'm happy. I'm not that angry, sullen man that I used to always be. I believe in the people that come in and come out of here, and I believe sincerely that what I do, no matter how small and minute it may seem to be, I want to make sure that people understand that I'm here for them.
There are currently 436 veterans courts around the country, 13 of which are in Arizona. Tempe, Pima County, and Kingman are the most recent courts to adopt versions of the program.
Good luck in the program.
Olivia Richard, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This week's election brought an end to Sheriff Joe Arpaio's 24 years in office here in Maricopa County, which has been celebrated by many Hispanic advocacy organizations that campaigned against him. One of those groups is the Arizona Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. The show's Lauren Gilger joins us now with more on this. And Lauren, the chamber is focused on advocating for Hispanic-owned businesses. So what's their role in the sheriff's race?
They endorsed Democratic candidate and now sheriff-elect Paul Pinzon during the election, and they were one of many groups that in 2010 filed a lawsuit over SB 1070, the law that included the controversial Show Me Your Papers provision that Arpaio was in favor of. So I talked to James Garcia about this on Skype today. He's the director of communications with the Arizona Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, and he says they're involved in all of this because Sheriff Arpaio's policies may have been about immigration, but they had a huge effect on the economy as well.
We're absolutely convinced that the kind of image and reputation that Sheriff Arpaio contributed to, putting the state in a very bad light in the same way that SB 1070 did, you know, that kind of negative image, that kind of negative reputation is harmful to the economy in a number of ways. One of the most obvious is that it hurts tourism. People who think you live in an intolerant state may not want to come visit. And it also is damaging in that it makes it difficult to recruit new workers and help build up the economy. So there's a connection, in our view, between who is sheriff and the kinds of actions that they are engaged in and whether or not they are casting not just Maricopa County, but our state in a bad light. There is a connection between that and the economy.
So you're talking a lot about the effects on the larger economy and the state's economy. How do you think Arpaio and his policies, how do you think that those affected particularly the Latino community of businesses and small businesses?
If there are Hispanic professionals in the country who were thinking about coming to take a job here with anyone, Intel, Cox, Apple, and they hesitated because they believed that Arizona is a racist state. That hurts our ability to attract good talent, including Hispanic talent. In the more working class jobs, such as in the construction industry, which certainly before the recession was heavily, heavily weighted towards Hispanic workers, if you saw literally tens of thousands of those workers flee the state in the wake of SB 1070 or flee the state because they were afraid that Sheriff Arpaio's raids could swoop them up, that has a direct impact on the economy. Right now, if you talk to construction companies, they are very concerned that even as the economy recovers, that they do not have enough workers.
Right. So your hopes for Paul Pinzon in office, what are some of the specific things that you hope he does to address the Hispanic community here in the Valley?
Well, I think he has an enormous task ahead of him in terms of becoming the face of the department and delivering a message that essentially says to the Latino community that we must have your participation in what we call sort of public safety on a daily basis. And the only way that I'm going to gain your trust and help you help me keep our community safe is by letting you know that you can trust me, that I will not send my officers out randomly to Hispanic neighborhoods to pull people over, sometimes based simply on the color of their skin. What I'm going to do as a sheriff is go out and enforce the laws that are on the books, do it fairly, because that's what police departments are supposed to do. Now, it won't be easy. One of the challenges that he will have is that he will still initially be working with a police force that operated under the rules that were devised by Sheriff Arpaio. And so he will have to address that however he thinks is necessary in terms of professionalizing his force. And so he will have that challenge when it comes to Hispanics in the community who may feel like they have been targets, because they will essentially say, yeah, you're the top guy and we trust you, but what about your deputies? Part of what he will also have to do, which I think he's already been doing even as a candidate, he's going to have to make connections with Hispanic leadership, people who have direct lines to Hispanics in the community at the grassroots level on the front lines, so that we as a community, if we believe in him, can help him relay that message. And that will make his job a little bit easier, but it's going to take time. He has to dismantle a reputation that has been built up for 20 plus years, and it will take him, fortunately, some time to bring things back to some sense of normalcy.
And I also spoke with Sheriff-elect Paul Pinzon shortly after he was elected on Tuesday night, and I asked him how he planned to bring the community together after so many years of division. Here's what he had to say.
The community will be in partnership. There should not be a division where we look at it and say the law enforcement and the community at large. No, we're one and the same. Law enforcement is an extension of the community, so we need to wrap our arms around that and our heads around it and say we're in this together.
And that's the show's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you.
A new service for veterans in the Valley will launch on Monday. Its goal is to help answer veterans' questions about living here and connect them to the services they need. With me to talk about Vets Community Connections are Kathy Hancock, Executive Director at the law firm Fenimore Craig and a member of Vets Community Connections Advisory Board, and Dorina Bustamante, Director of Community Engagement for Downtown Phoenix, Inc. and a volunteer with VCC. And Kathy, let me start with you. How exactly does this work?
The program right now is concentrating on signing up volunteers like Dorina and many, many others who have a service or just information, want to serve as a resource, and want to give back. And Monday, this coming Monday, right after Veterans Day, the program launches via 211. And the great thing about 211 is it provides a trained vets connector to answer calls from veterans, military, active military, and families on any question they have. It can be as simple as, where do I take my daughter for dance lessons, to what's a great neighborhood.
So military veterans can call 211 and basically somebody will answer and the veteran will say, okay, well, I need some information about this. The person who answers the phone will say, we have just the person for that, and then get that person on the line or set up a time to communicate later and get that information. Is that about right?
That's absolutely correct. And one of the things that we discovered, there is an abundance of resources out there, including a lot of nonprofit organizations that are terrific in terms of serving different segments of the active duty military and veteran community and their families. But it's that linkage that you need, where you have somebody come into a community, no network, and you don't know what organization to call. So 211 through Arizona Community Information and Referral, which has been around for years, was the natural platform with the addition of these trained VETS connectors to make it very easy for people to talk to a human being, explain what it is they're looking for, and end up with the right resource.
Dorina, what kinds of questions are you expecting to get? What kinds of questions are you prepared to answer?
I'm expecting to get all sorts of questions. The questions that I'll personally be equipped to answer have a lot to do with volunteer opportunities, have a lot to do with education resources. So I'm actually excited to hear what the questions are, because downtown Phoenix is the urban heart of Arizona. So I think that we are excited about being able to answer a lot of questions and direct people in the right direction.
Do you expect to use both your professional knowledge from working at Downtown Phoenix, Inc., as well as sort of your personal knowledge of having lived here for most, if not all, of your life to be able to help folks?
Certainly. Like I said, as a fifth-generation Arizonan, it's always exciting to roll out the red carpet for people. This is especially important for veterans and their families to be able to do this.
One of the really nice things about the VETS Community Connections program is that, you know, my father's generation, virtually every family he was in contact with had somebody who served in World War II. Decades go by, and now less than 1%, about 0.5% of the population serves in the military. And so when those folks enter the community, they aren't surrounded by people who understand what that process has been, what the experience is, what the challenges are with family members, and the personal experiences they've had. So this whole program is intended to support those folks who come into community and, unlike decades ago, have no network and they're not surrounded by people who understand their circumstance.
Is this program modeled on something that is going on somewhere else? I mean, is there anything else like this anywhere else?
This program was initiated out of Washington, D.C. The first pilot community was San Diego County. The next was the county in which South Bend, Indiana is located. And Phoenix, Arizona, and Maricopa County is the third in the country. The intention is that these are the pilot projects to roll this out across the country, because the need is clearly all over.
Dorina, how do you try to pitch this to friends and family and people that you come
into contact
them. With?
Just kidding. No, I mean, here's the thing. We're in a point in time, to Kathy's point a few minutes ago, about the fact that when she was growing up, her parents and her family, it was such close proximity to someone who was enlisted or a veteran, which is totally true, and times they have changed. And I don't think that that's for a lack of people's interest in their patriotism, but for whatever reason, those of us who have not had the opportunity or the courage to serve in that way really want to give back, and we really want to do something to say more than just thank you. And if we can help with this reintegration process, I mean, there's nothing more neighborly than that, and there's nothing more American than that, in my mind.
In some ways, do you think this will help this community, in addition to helping the veterans who are using the service, that you're, in a way, integrating folks who might be new to this community, you're helping to integrate them into it?
That's a great way to describe it, because the intent is that it does exactly that. It accelerates the integration of these new community members, people we want to welcome, we want them to feel supported, and we want to keep them here.
And there are such great key partners involved. 211 Arizona National Association of Counties Wounded Warrior Project. Are you kidding? These are great groups. And VCC is a channel to connect and create a bridge to supplement existing programs to veterans. So this isn't to say do this and nothing else. This is an additional bonus to all these great existing programs.
Dorina Bustamante is Director of Community Engagement for Downtown Phoenix, Inc., and a volunteer with Vets Community Connections. We also heard from Kathy Hancock. She's Executive Director at the law firm Fenimore Craig and a member of Vets Community Connections Advisory Board.
The off-ice drama of the Arizona Coyotes has been told before. The ownership problems, arena issues, battles with the city of Glendale, and even though the organization is off to a slow start on the ice this season, with 5 wins in their first 13 games, the team has a lot of promising 19-to-21-year-old players. Plus, there's even a lot of buzz about a new place to play. With me to talk about the Coyotes is Paula Bovin, columnist for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central Sports. Paula, the optimism of fans has been dashed in the past, so is there really a good reason to be optimistic about the Coyotes now?
I think there is. You know, and Steve, it's tricky because, well, how many times as a sports fan in the Valley have people sort of felt let down? You know, the hype, the promise. We kind of saw it with the Cardinals. We've certainly seen it with the Diamondbacks. And so the instinct now is to be like, whatever, you know, here we go again. But it feels different this time to me, and part of it is it sounds like they're close to sort of settling on an arena. The young players that they have are ones that are getting a lot of respect, you know, in the hockey world beyond the Valley, in Canada, and writers and sort of and analysts and things like that. So people seem excited about what this team has. It's just sort of a matter, you know, let's not screw this up, because it's been quite a while since this team has really, really made an impact.
Yeah, Paul, it's such a weird time because the expectations for the Cardinals were over the moon this year, and they've struggled. You know, maybe they'll still be a playoff team, but they haven't been that Super Bowl favorite that people had hoped. Suns are again in another rebuilding mode. Diamondbacks, new management in place again. Are the Coyotes in some way, do they have the potential to really grab the market at this point? Because I think there are still some people who are cynical about hockey in the desert, regardless of the talent that's coming out.
No, yeah, absolutely. That's a great point. I think there's opportunity here for them. I don't know if they'll sort of seize the community, but they need to win and win consistently and go to the playoffs. Nothing is better than playoff hockey. And when you can get the community caught up in that, the whiteout, you don't even have to be a hardcore fan. Add to the fact that most people, at least who cover the sports, agree. I mean, hockey players, you get to know them, they're very likable. A lot of them are from small towns in Canada. They're just approachable. I think there's a real opportunity for this community to embrace this club. But, you know, when you've had this cloud of where are we going to play, when they haven't been winning games, when they haven't been getting into the postseason, that's a hard thing to do. So, you know, with so many questions about the other organizations in town, I just think it's a good opportunity for them right now.
It's really, really a young organization. How patient do you think the community will be and has to be?
Yeah, I think they have to be, because there's going to be some ups and downs, obviously, when you have a group this talented. But if they're playing an exciting brand of hockey, if they're in games, but there's definitely going to be a need to have patience, because, you know, when you're this young, as we saw, I think, early in the season, there are going to be struggles.
And Paula, finally, do you think we're in a situation now where the organization, you talked about the likelihood of getting a new arena, is it finally off the Canadian sports pages in the sense of, hey, here's another perhaps American team we can pick off and bring back to Canada?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's always going to be speculation. Anytime I go to the message boards related to the Coyotes, there's always some that are kind of jumping on from Canada saying it's time. But I think this latest ownership group and their commitment and what looks like an arena coming into place, I think, has finally quieted some of the speculation. And the reality is the NHL wants hockey in the Sun Belt to work, and they are committed to it, as they've showed in the past. They were, I think, temporary owners for a while. They want it to work here. So I think it would be very hard at this point to think something like that could happen.
Paula Bovin is a columnist for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central Sports. And Paula, nice to talk with you. Thank you.
Nice to talk to you too, Steve.
So, Steve, we have a very special birthday today.
Oh, is it yours, Mark?
It is not. It is actually something a little bit older than me. Route 66 turns 90 today. It was established November 11th, 1926 as Highway US 66.
It winds from Chicago to L.A. More than 2,000 miles all the way.
To celebrate, we talked with Arizona travel writer Roger Naylor. He's the author of the book Arizona Kicks on Route 66.
I think everything we know about road trips, we learn from Route 66 because this changed how America traveled. We were still a nation that traveled by train for the most part.
The road gave drivers freedom to explore America in a new way.
Flagstaffers on her, don't forget Banana, Kingman, Boston, San Bernardino.
You can pull over and sleep in a wigwam, or you can pull over at an old trading post or a place where you see some old ruins and stop and take a photo.
And, you know, get your kicks.
On Route 66.
But in the 70s and 80s, the highway had something of a midlife crisis.
Route 66 ceased to exist in 1985. It wasn't just a lack of popularity. It disappeared. It was gone.
It was removed from the U.S. highway system, and the quicker, smoother interstate replaced it.
And the only reason it came back is because of a handful of residents in a little town called Seligman, Arizona, led by the town barber, Angel Delgadillo.
Naylor says that Seligman barber formed the first historic Route 66 association to lobby for a historic designation for the road, and they got it.
That's one of the reasons that I love it so much, is that it wasn't saved by government, it wasn't saved by corporations, it was saved by individuals, by people who stepped up and said, I want to preserve this piece of our heritage.
Drivers like Naylor were happy to take the road more traveled after it rose in popularity again.
Contrary to what our fathers taught us, a good road trip isn't defined by making good time. It's about having a good time. I've got this little device in my truck that I use all the time, and it's really proven very effective for me. It's right by the gas pedal. It's called the brake. I just try to use it a lot when I'm on the road. If I see something I want to check out, I pull over, I stop.
And one of his favorite stops is a hiking trail near a rest stop called Cool Springs.
So it goes up to this high promontory across the road up on this mesa, and you have views all across the Black Mountains that gnaw the clouds with the broken teeth of these rambling ridge lines. It's just a beautiful, beautiful scenery, and you see back down the old highway, and you can listen to the burros from Oatman braying in the evening air and watch the sun go down, and I think that's my favorite spot on Route 66.
Naylor says proudly the Arizona portion of Route 66 has the longest unbroken stretch, as well as the steepest grade, the longest curve, and the only portion that goes through a national park, the Petrified Forest.
Well, we don't have a birthday card because, frankly, we don't know what part of the road to mail it to, but we'd like to send over Naylor's well wishes.
Thanks for all the memories that you've given me all these years. I know some people consider roads inanimate, but how can something that's not alive create such great memories? How can something without pulse give us back pieces of our youth that we thought we'd lost? So thank you and happy birthday, and I look forward to the next 90.
Roger Naylor is talking about Route 66 history and culture in Phoenix tomorrow. There's more information on our website, kjzz.org.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.